Right, brainstorming. What's funny? What's funny? Chickens. Are chickens funny?
Depends what you do with them, I suppose.
What? I wouldn't do that with a chicken.
Do what?
I mean, where would you put the beak?
Beak quiet. I'm trying to think.
Oh, that was really bad.
You wrote it.
Fair point.
Come on, Sarah. We're meant to be brainstorming funny, comedy ha-ha. Research for your comedy producer interview with Ed.
Oh, yeah. Do you know what I really want to know is, what does a producer actually do?
Hello and welcome to the Audio Drama Production Podcast. I'm Fiona.
And I'm Sarah.
And today, Sarah has an interview with Ed Morrish.
Yes.
Comedy producer for the BBC and also independently too.
Yeah, he's such a busy boy. Oh my goodness, the last however many years of his life. I think he must be 60-something now to have fitted all that into such an amazing space of time. And he's pretty much worked with all the people that I think are amazing. So, yeah, it was a kind of a, you know, in those cartoons when they have the kind of diamonds in their eyes listening to something amazing, that was me chatting to him.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, basically he does. He's had the most extraordinary career, hasn't he?
He hasn't finished yet. He's still going.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, I'm not suggesting. But, like, yeah, literally, if you listen to certainly Radio 4 comedies, you can bet he's behind quite a lot of them that you love.
And that, we found him fascinating to talk to just because he's got such a range of experience. So not just with comedy shows as in sitcom-wise, but in the sketch shows and with panel shows as well, where comedians and other animals have jumped on to play. So yes, I don't think there's much more to say other than here's Ed Morrish talking about what it is to be a comedy producer.
Fantastic.
Huzzah. Edward Morrish. Hello, Ed. How are
you? Hello, I'm very well, thank you.
Very good to see you. First things first, you're one of those renowned radio producers I know working in comedy today, and the list of shows that you've got under your belt are absolutely astounding. I don't know if you want to list some of the fun things you've been working on the last however many years you've been in comedy.
I don't know. Well, I mean, that's very nice of you to say. I don't know if I am renowned. After I've been making shows in Edinburgh for Radio 4 for about 10 years, someone once stopped me outside a recording and went, "Are you that BBC man?" And I think that's about the right level of fame for a radio producer. People don't typically know who we are. But if you've heard my name, it's because it's been on the end of programmes like John Finnemore's Souvenir Programme, yep. Paul Sinha's History Revision, and other shows that Paul Sinha's done. Dilemma, the panel show with Sue Perkins, Welcome to Our Village, Please Invade Carefully, and Lem Sisse's recent stuff for Radio 4, Homecoming, Origin Stories, Henry Normal's programme last summer. I did the news quiz for 2 years. I did the Now show for a year. I've done one series of quote-unquote. So it's mainly Radio 4 stuff. Obviously, Welcome to Our Village started a pilot on Radio 2, mm-hmm. and I did a sitcom pilot with Rod Gilbert for Radio 2. Mainly it's been Radio 4. But yeah, Souvenir Programme is the one most people have heard of.
Yes, fantastic. And how did you start out in comedy? How have you got
involved? I've always loved radio comedy. My dad used to play us tapes of Hitchhikers, and he got us Roundhorn and Hitchhikers and the Goon Show were the three that I remember most clearly growing up. But then he also bought tapes of On the Hour and Know Me, Knowing You.
Yeah,
I think he got us Why Bother when that came out on tape, which is my uncle bought us Derek and Clive Live, and my mum spoke to him for a while after that.
Yes,
wildly inappropriate thing to give a 13-year-old, but she had already bought me so the Mary Whitehouse experience. No, just these things seep in. One of the things that got me into comedy was you, actually, because you put on a play of Witches Abroad in Edinburgh in 1997, which I was in to shift scenery and have one scene
and
where
a marvellous
I
job you did there.
Had to wear green corduroy lederhosen.
I remember
flying up the Royal Mile in 1997, 1 month shy of my 18th birthday, flying in this quite remarkable outfit, which sort of toughens you up. My route into doing it professionally, I suppose just for the love of green corduroy lederhosen, was I was working for the BBC message boards. I was sort of moderating those, so sitting on the message boards and sort of removing spam and threats and abuse.
I didn't send any of that, wasn't me.
No. And I was banging on about, I think it was the Now Show. I'd heard the Now Show and it had been really good that week. And I mentioned it to a colleague and they said, oh, have you thought about going for that job? And it was a job for a trainee radio producer. And I didn't have much time to apply. So I just sort of shoved in an application that said more or less that I have no experience in radio or comedy apart from going up to Edinburgh when I was 17. But I know loads and loads about radio comedy. Can I have a job? And I'm remarkably through sort of a couple of stages of application process, I managed to get it. Who would have thought life would be so easy at the BBC for a well-spoken middle-class white boy? That's well, quite the shock.
Yeah, shocker, absolutely. And with regards to the day-to-day workings of what you were doing, so the traineeship did what?
Training isn't what it was. We were given a phone and a desk and a computer login and told off you go, and we had one day I think where like a production coordinator or broadcast assistant sat us down and explained this is how productions, like this is the sort of timeline, so you get commissioned here, if you're going out here then you need to have it recorded by here, this is how, and that was sort of, you know, the nuts and bolts of radio production can be told to you in a day. That's that there's sort of, it's not changed in 60 years. I did just under the third series of the Missing Hancocks.
Yes,
so scripts that were made in 1954 1955. Yeah. The recordings have been lost and we're recreated with Kevin McNally as Tony Hancock, and this series Andy Secombe as Harry Secombe, because there were some episodes that Hancock didn't turn up for. And looking at the scripts, it just rams home that the changes in how radio programmes are made between 1954 and 2017 are actually mainly technological. It's the actual process, the actual toolkit you have to work with is words, music, effects and silence and an audience, if you have an audience. But those five things are, that's what you've got to put through people's speakers or through their headphones. So it's actually very simple. The traineeship was just more an opportunity to watch a load of really talented people making radio programmes. So people like Dawn Ellis, who does John Shuttleworth shows, and Lucy Armitage, who was making Paperback Hell at the time, Helen Williams, Mario Stiolini, just watching really talented people go about it. And what you, in lieu of any sort of supervision, you just go, oh, I like that, I'll do that.
Right.
I like that, I'll do that. I mean, what I learned from, for example, what I learned from Lucy is how enthusiastic she was about her programme. She absolutely loves what she does. And I remember thinking, because I'd been reading a lot of the unsolicited scripts that just came in, you know, just people had written scripts, sent it to BBC Radio Comedy.
Yeah, brilliant.
And you're reading it and you go, well, I mean, I don't find it that funny, but I've heard worse. I've heard worse on air, so maybe this should go. You know,
give it a chance.
I said, yeah, maybe I should put it forward. And then watching Lucy, I just thought, if I don't love something this much, why would I bother? Surely that's the privilege of the job, to be able to... I used to compare it to making a mixtape for a girl you liked. And it's sort of like that, but with a million listeners. Like, I like this. And if you like this, then you'll like me. That's the sort of ethos. So I saw Paul Sinha do a set and thought he was brilliant. I thought, oh, more people should know how great Paul Sinha is.
Fantastic.
Or John Finnemore or Eddie Robson I met. He sent in a sketch to an open door sketch show I did. And I just wanted to show more people his writing because I think he's really funny.
Yeah.
And so the traineeship is, the amount of actual training. I got sent on a director's course when I'd been doing the job for 5 years.
Wow. And
so I just, the week before, I'd finished recording the second series of a sitcom, and one of the actors on the course, who was sort of job it is to make it difficult for you, Rachel Atkins, I think she'd actually been in that, and she was like, oh, this is what I was doing wrong, this is, no one tells me, but you just find your own way of mixing those five elements of words, sounds, music, silence and audience, putting them together in a way that you like, I think is what you learn to do.
Yeah. I mean, wouldn't you talk us through now, currently, how you're working? Because you've moved away from working with the BBC and you're kind of more of an independent producer currently.
Oh, well, I'm still working through the BBC quite a lot. And at the moment, I'm doing Paul Sinha's History Revision Series 3. Mm-hmm. So that's just a BBC Studios production. I mean, that's just a technicality that I stopped being a member of staff at the BBC. Mm-hmm. It was when I joined BBC Radio Entertainment, then became BBC Radio Comedy. Yep. And then became part of BBC production and now is BBC Studios, which becomes a wholly owned subsidiary of the BBC Group and therefore an independent production company on the 17th of April, I think. Uh-huh. And I don't work for them.
Right.
But they pay me to make programmes for them.
Okay.
On a programme-by-programme basis. But I also have been making programmes for something else, the production company for Audible.
And yes, we know Audible.
Yes, and it's exactly the same process from my point of view, which is that I had these, you know, people have sent me these scripts that I really liked and I showed them to Audible and Audible said no to some and yes to some others and they've asked us to record them. So we have to negotiate a budget. How much is it going to cost? When do you want them? And aside from, you know, the fact that I don't have to go into an office every day, it's broadly the same. It's the same responsibilities, I think. It might be different if I was an independent production company by myself, because then you're taking up a lot more responsibility. And in fact, I'm doing a podcast with Luke Roberts and Tony Law. Uh-huh. So I'm getting more into the slightly self-sufficient side of audio.
Okay.
But I haven't gone there enough. I've always had a fairly large company, or the largest company in the history of the BBC, backing me.
Okay. So how does that make a difference at a live recording then? So what would your responsibilities as a producer be?
I think they'd be the same. And I think your there's a legal responsibility as a live recording. So if there's a fire and people haven't been told where the fire exits are, you get sued. So you have to make sure that those announcements are made and people switch off their mobile phones. Mm. It's helpful that I always find the producers warm up. The producer gets to do a warm up at shows if they want to. And I'm a massive show off, as you know. So I tend to. It's an opportunity to sort of set out the stall for the night. We're going to do this and we're going to do it for this long. Yeah. And there's, you know, if there's an interval or if people need to leave the room or whatever, just take on the responsibility for saying all the boring stuff. So then Paul can come on and start the show, or John, the way John Finnemore likes to warm up the souvenir programme audience is to play Guess Who with the front three rows. So he gets the front three rows to stand up and they pick one person and then he plays it with the rest of the crowd. But it's subjective Guess Who. So after he's gone through, you know, do they have a beard or whatever? And it's like, would you let them look after your kids? But John doesn't have to do the, he just gets to do the fun bits and I get to do the fire exits are there and it's going to take about 50 minutes and then there'll be retakes and then you have to leave the room, which would be quite tedious. The other responsibility that producer has is responsibility for making sure it's a good night.
Mm-hmm.
Because as much as you can dissociate the recording and the broadcast, and I think it really helps to dissociate those two things, don't think of your broadcast as a version of the live recording. Consider them two separate things.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's going to make the broadcast version good is if the audience like everything. If I was doing a double recording of a sitcom, for example, and a sitcom shouldn't record at much more than 35 minutes.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's a 28-minute slot on broadcast, so you're looking to not have to hack it down too much.
Mm.
Yeah, we'd always have an interval.
Mm-hmm.
Because people can go to the loo, or I mean, whether they open the bar or not, depends on the venue or whatever. But it just gives people a chance to refresh. And also people who aren't enjoying it can leave. And that sounds like a really pessimistic thing, but it's better that they go than someone who would have laughed be sat next to someone who's not enjoying it.
Yep.
So often second halves, even if 10 people leave, because they've decided, oh, I'd rather get the earlier train, or they're not feeling it. The second halves often go better. The audience are more warmed up. They're more into it. The people who stayed are, the people who are keener on it, 50 minutes at most for a 20-minute slot.
Mm-hmm.
So even when you DM and DR, you're down to, you know, 40 to 45 just by cutting out, just by tightening it up. And I think that, you know, 50 minutes is sort of a good length of a show. I'm speaking specifically about comedy here, of course.
Yeah.
Don't know what the equivalent would be in drama, but if you do a bad joke, the next good joke won't land as well because people just
still reacting.
Lose the enthusiasm. Yeah. One of the best recordings I ever did was the first of Paul Sinha's citizenship test, I think it was.
Mm.
And it lasted 45 minutes and three jokes didn't work in the entire recording.
Wow, great.
Which meant that there was just this brilliant rolling laugh. Because
yeah.
you tell them a joke and then they tell them another joke and it just builds and builds and eventually they're laughing at everything.
Mm.
If you tell three bad jokes in a row,
mm-hmm.
you've broken that. Mm. And then they have to get their energy back up again.
Mm.
Whereas if you can just go through. They were, oh, I laughed 45 minutes and then I got to go home. So that's a good night out.
I mean, how much input would you have as a producer on that script? Because obviously you have seen its potential and potentially worked with the author.
I think it depends on the writer. I mean, if you go on the Writer's Room website, Eddie Robson, who's done a lot of work with the Writer's Room, put up all 8 drafts of an episode of Welcome to Our Village, piece of made carefully from the sort of draft zero, where, I mean, just to get a thing written,
right,
just to get that first splurge onto the page.
Mm.
And in fact, we wanted to do it. We thought we'd do this for the first episode of the series, because that'd be a good way of promoting the series on the Writers' Room.
Yep.
And then we realised the first episode of the series basically didn't change. It just sort of got some better jokes. So we did the second one because that had quite a big structural change where it went back and forth and we realised we were over time and we had to cut it down.
Mm.
And with Eddie, I had a script editor in Arthur Matthews, so I had an exec producer. And so we had agreed what the plot was. We'd agreed what all the plots were before we started the series.
Mm.
And then it was his job to go off and write that, send me a draft, and then I'd give him feedback.
Mm.
I don't think we junked any on that series.
Mm.
That can happen if you just go, this isn't working, I don't know why, and you start on something else. Sometimes, you know, story ideas are better than you can execute them.
Yep.
With Paul, I mean, we just agree a subject and he goes off and writes it and then sends me a script and I send him some notes and he sends me another script, I send him more notes and then we record it. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. On the day, we will read it through twice just to tweak things. But he's so obsessive about fact-checking and such a good joke writer.
Yes.
And those are the two elements of the show. It's funny jokes and interesting facts, and he's good at both of them. With Souvenir Programme, because John tries out all the sketches live before he even sends them to me,
right,
he doesn't send me sketches that don't make people laugh in the room.
Yep.
So
amazing.
At that point, I might have minor technical things. My main contribution on Souvenir Programme recording script is putting them in an order that will be enjoyed on the night.
Mm-hmm.
So you space your runners out, you make sure the songs are different in each half.
Mm-hmm.
John doesn't pretend to be an animal in consecutive sketches. And then what we then do, because we record 6 50-minute shows, is we chop those recordings up. Actually, John's started printing out bespoke cards where he can sort of highlight who's in them, what sort of sketch it is, obviously all the Since You Asked Me sketches that go at the end.
Yep.
And we just literally sit at a table with post-it notes
and draw up post-it
sketches.
Notes.
Yeah, so that running order on the night isn't necessarily the version you hear on air, because we might move stuff around and switch stuff up and decide that actually most of this recording isn't going to get used, we're going to use another recording.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't actually have to work on the script per se.
For your life at the minute, you're obviously still very much in touch with comedians that are working currently. Do you as a producer go out and hunt for new talent still in that way?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I was in Edinburgh. I did a programme for the World Service called What Makes the World Laugh, which was international stand-ups. BBC 7 was just starting, and they were mainly archiving. They wanted some new content and rightly realised that stand-up is the cheapest thing you can do, because you just need a room and then you pay someone. You don't have to pay them to write it because they've written it. So it's, you pay them for the performance of their pre-existing material. But this is 2003.
Okay.
This was. So most of these people weren't certainly weren't as well known as they are now.
Right.
And for that show, the remit was new people. So I was out sort of 5-6 nights a week. I lived in London at the time and I could go out and see a show and sort of see who I liked and then get the bus home. But now, because I don't have a show that demands new people, I probably don't go to that level of gig anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The way you can sell stuff to Radio 4 or Audible, I mean, Audible certainly like a bit of profile.
Yes.
They like a name you might conceivably enter into a search bar.
Yes.
I think it's fair to say. Because, you know, just having everyone thinks the comedy they make is funny. So what makes your funny funnier than the other person's funny. You need something to stand out. And in terms of Radio 4, I mean, if you're not at the level of having done an Edinburgh show, mm-hmm. you know, an hour-long show, the chances that people will take the risk on you to write, as a writer-performer, that is,
yeah.
the chance that people will ask you to write a show is minimal. Because, mm-hmm. you know, that was one of the things about Edinburgh, is you can show you can hold a story over 50 to 55 minutes.
Yes.
Which, I guess, I don't even do shows with multiple writers. You know, if I was producing the News Quiz on an hour show, I'd probably be going to go to the Cutting Edge mm-hmm. and other gigs. And if you saw somebody did really good topical stuff, you'd say, hey, come and write.
Yeah, brilliant.
Because I don't do that sort of show.
Mm-hmm.
And there's less scope for selling that type of show. Mm-hmm. I don't do that, but I do try to go and try to go out at least once a week to see something, to at least keep in touch.
Yep.
You know, the Soho Theatre is brilliant because yes. you can go and see two shows in a night. Because, you know, if I'm missing the kids' bath time, I may as well make a night of it.
Daddy first.
Daddy first.
So you mentioned earlier the fact that unsolicited scripts were sent to you, and at certain points you could look at those as a BBC producer. How would people get their work to someone like you as an independent producer today?
The main thing is it's a polite way of saying don't just send me your script. Because the point I was going to make is that don't send a script necessarily to someone who's made the sort of show that your script is like.
Mm-hmm.
So I did Welcome to Our Village, which is a sci-fi sitcom, and I got sent a lot of sci-fi sitcoms.
Yep.
And the thing is, I'm probably not going to be able to pitch that because the amount of space for sci-fi is limited.
Yep.
And if I pitch two, the commission editor might go, we only want one. I think it's different for Audible. I think Audible, being a commercial entity, would go, oh, great, people like sci-fi, let's do more sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
But Audible are still sort of working out their commissioning process, and they're going through a lot of different styles of structures.
Mm-hmm.
So thinking about Radio 4, yeah, I would have that issue. And, you know, for some of the reasons, I haven't really pitched a straight-ahead sketch show while I've been doing Souvenir Programme.
Yes.
There's only so much space for straight-ahead sketch shows, and I do one of the best. Why would I compete against myself? Hey, do you want this? It's not quite as good as Souvenir Programme. It's not the best way to sell a programme, so I'll leave it to other people who think they've got something better. But send it to someone whose humour you like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if someone makes stuff, look for the names in the credits. If you like their stuff and you think your stuff's in a similar tone, then finding their email addresses is quite easy.
Yep.
You know, if they're BBC, it's very easy because I think it's all listed on their
yes.
website. I'm pretty Googleable. Most of us yep. are. If we're not, the production company is.
Yep.
You know, the number of production companies that make stuff for Radio 4 is not vast. So you can probably find a web address and from there a contact email address. And it may take a while because we're all, you know, busy people. But there's sort of two ways of looking at how producers look for new stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's the cynical version, which is they just want to be associated with hits.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the uncynical version, which is we love finding new comedy and want to show off like a
yes.
mixtape to a girlfriend. Either way, we need new stuff,
yeah,
whichever absolutely. Way you want to look at it. So you may as well, we will read as much as we can
mm-hmm.
because either we want to buy another Ferrari the proceeds of your glorious success, or because we want to get brilliant stuff
yeah.
on air and we want to be all enthusiastic about it.
I mean, you've read obviously hundreds and thousands of scripts. I mean, what top tips would you give writers as to the do's and don'ts? Are there some key things you can suggest?
I don't think there are do's and don'ts because I was telling you before we recorded, I read the pilot script to Ed Reardon's Week and I didn't
yeah.
get it.
Yeah.
I just read it. I was like, what's the joke? I don't get it. And if it had been left up to me that, you know, if I'd had the casting vote, we might not have had Ed Reardon. Yeah. And then I heard it and it was like, oh,
yeah.
That's, yeah, I couldn't,
yeah.
All right, yes. And it took Simon Nichols to actually, when I heard it, that you could go, oh, yes, I see now. Yeah, I was wrong about that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously there's lots of successful comedy on TV and radio and in film that mm-hmm. I don't like, that, you know, I can analyse endlessly why it doesn't work. But
yeah.
it doesn't matter if people like it, does it? All the rules go out the window if you have something successful.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, things I don't like, I think if you're a recent university graduate writing a sitcom about some recent university graduates, it had better be really interesting because just three recent university graduates sharing a house is not inherently fascinating to me. I think siblings who inherit a business,
mm-hmm.
they're often quite different. One's a bit uptight, one's a bit not. I read that a lot in a lot of different variations, which is not to say that you can't do it. In fact, Kieran Hodgson and Tom Meltz had a nice pilot sweats that went out a couple of weeks ago, a couple of months ago, and that was that premise.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it's one of those things that producers see a lot and so are...
Finally gave in.
Well, I think it's Kieran because he got like, A1 Best Newcomer at Edinburgh, although actually Alex had the script, was championing the script before then, Alex Smith, the producer. The two scripts I always get sent that I never get made, so I don't know if people know that we get loads of versions of these. A small island, last outpost of the British Empire that serves as a sort of miniature allegory for Britain.
Right.
So, you know, they'll be doing jokes about the Department of Transport when it's the bus company. It's the bus driver. Normally like Rockall, but, you know, somewhere else.
Yes.
And the other one is a semi-improvised sitcom about the entertainment industry by comedians and actors. And I'm expecting to see that a lot more now. Curb Your Enthusiasm's coming back.
Oh, yes.
I see it quite a lot.
Series 20 million.
Series nine. Yeah, they're slow, as Larry David said. I've been busy. But aside from those, you know, themes and structures, and again, people have got this made, but my personal feeling is if you're writing, start in the sitcom you want us to read. Yeah. So many people send their first script and expositional first episode where all the characters come into place. They start off not knowing each other. By the end of the episode, hey, I guess we're running this shoe shop after all. And then the next five episodes will be them running the shoe shop. You don't need that because most people won't hear the first episode. So why not see if it works from the opening? In fact, again, I think it's on the writer's room. Eddie Robson wrote an expositional first episode of Welcome to Our Village. Wasn't called that, it was called The Resistance at the time. And it was the episode where Katrina Lyons realises she's locked in the village. It starts on the Sunday night, the barrier, the impenetrable heat barrier. If you haven't heard Welcome to Our Village, it's on Audible, but this next couple of minutes is going to be impenetrable to you. As impenetrable as a heat barrier that's been dropped around Creston Green. She's trying to leave and Uliban reveals himself to be an alien. And it was a funny script, but it spent 20 minutes to get to the point where the heat barriers come down.
Right.
And that's the only reason I'm interested in that story. It's because aliens have taken over the village. I'm not interested in her setting up relationships with all these people in the village where she grew up, where she doesn't like, who she doesn't like. So let's just get to the good stuff. And in fact, quite a lot of the jokes in that script, Eddie used again.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there were little character jokes and little bits of backstory that could be alluded to and you could have fun with. But if your show doesn't hit the ground running, that would be another reason that I'd get to the end of the script and go, well, that was interesting, but now I've got to read another script to work out if this sitcom is any good.
Right.
Hit the ground running. Start where you start. One of the best ones for that, if you can get a copy, is the first episode of Cheers.
Okay, yeah.
Which is just opening the bar. And obviously everyone knows everyone in Cheers. That's part of the point of the show. Mm-hmm. And so it's just in the first act of 10 minutes, everyone in that series comes in and does a thing in the style of that person.
Right.
And you can get every character from, you know, Carla coming in and just being rude to everyone, and Norm coming in. And just, they introduce everyone in an incredibly natural way.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have to do all of that awkward expositional dialogue.
Yeah.
The thing that Terry Pratchett always used to, as you know, your father, the king, which no one would ever say. So just skip to the second episode, I think, is the best advice you can give anyone.
It's like writing your novel, isn't it? So get rid of the first chapter and
Lawrence Howarth, who's a very funny comedy writer and actor, who is the script editor on Dead Ringers, I think. Mm-hmm. One of the main writers on Dead Ringers, certainly. He came up through Weekending, which was the open door sketch show that ran for 20 years.
Yeah.
And he said that it's like meconium. You know, if people who don't have babies might not know that babies have a very firm, sticky poo inside them, called meconium, which comes out as their first poo. And it's basically, it's slightly harder and it stops them being crushed inside the womb and just sort of slightly firmer. And that's inside them. And once that's out, their digestive system starts working normally. And he said that you've got all this stuff inside you, all these obvious jokes that you've picked up from being a comedy nerd and watching loads of comedy and listening to loads of comedy. And actually, the first things you do are going to be sticky and hard and not that pleasant. So get those out of your system. You have to write, and you have to write more.
Yep.
Was it Louise Doughty? She was saying on, she said on Quote Unquote that I produced, that there are 10 unpublished novels in her desk drawer.
Wow.
And she will have to go into hiding if any of them ever get out. Because For every apple tree yard, you have to like plow through something and look back and go, oh, that's not good enough. And sometimes it'll take someone else, like an agent or a producer, to go, this isn't good enough.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's important. I think that's one of the good things about Newsjack and now is that one of my favourite writers to work with at the moment, that sounds really like it's going to change. She's going to get attitude. But Gabby Hutchinson Crouch, who's on Twitter as @Scriblet. She's very funny. She's a very good writer. I found her when I was doing Newsjack. She sent in a sketch that was about Kate Middleton had been photographed topless. And we had a lot of sketches about it. And hers was the only angry one. And it was a spoof advert for Sexually Humiliating a Young Woman Weekly.
Right.
And just, you know, sort of tabloid ad. And then the next week she sent in a thing about Justin Lee Collins that was legally unbroadcastable. And then the next week she sent in a sketch about the gas companies, the energy companies, operating a cartel that opened with the line, "Hello, I'm an actress pretending to be Thora Heard." And honestly, I don't know if I even read the rest of the sketch. I was like, that's in. And by the end of the series, we were inviting her in. And it seemed like really quick. She got her first commission in the next series. So she'd gone from non-com, i.e. you get paid for what we broadcast, to we will pay you and we'll pay you up front. And she never under-delivered on her commission.
Fantastic.
And what I didn't know was that she'd been submitting every episode for the previous series, which I had also produced.
Right.
And her stuff hadn't made it through. I couldn't even tell you whether I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
I might have done. I read a large proportion of the submissions, but it gets outsourced around the department, so some will be a different producer.
Yes.
It might not just got to me, or it might have taken a series to really get honed and writing a couple of sketches every week to get good. And I think with sitcoms, as much as the expositional episode can help you to get to the point where your sitcom starts, you might be better off writing episode 2 and then sending that, because now you know who your characters are. You're going to be a bit more definitive about the choices you make and where they can go. The more you write characters, the more you sort of... I'll come back to Pratchett, actually, because we did that play, which he thought he never wanted to do the map
because
he thought it would limit him. But then he realised it actually opens up all these other things to him. He's sort of, oh, well, what if I now know you can't get to the shambles from the opera house?
Yeah.
And then realise, actually, well, no, because if that's there, then that has to go. And so the map that he and Stephen Briggs did actually made him start thinking, well, what if someone was there and there? And the more you write your sitcom characters, the more things they say, you're tying them down. So after the first episode of Welcome to Our Village, Peter Davison's character had to like cricket. That was in. He'd said it. He'd said he liked cricket.
Right.
But now we know he likes cricket. We've now given an excuse not to want to be around on a Saturday.
Okay.
Yeah, because he wants to play cricket. And you do restrict yourself and you are, you know, finding more about them. But you're also providing yourself with a toolkit to create more story.
Fantastic, yeah. And we've talked a little bit about a few people that you've kind of been drawn to working with. And you did, at some point, release a really exciting blog post about diversity in shows.
Oh, yes.
And I was just wondering about, you know, as a female podcaster, and there's a lot of angst about being fair about gender and cultural differences on broadcasting. I mean, would you say there's been any big changes in the last few years? And do you think your blog post, for example, made any difference in the...
Well, I don't think my blog post made any difference. You can read it on the New Statesman website
because
they picked it up and ran it on the condition they tidied up the grammar, which they didn't. I wrote it. I was drinking wine and watching Match of the Day. Danny Cohen's thing had come out. They were going to quota women onto panel shows, and I had a series of dilemma going out at the time.
Yep.
So I quickly wrote a thing about why I have put 2 women on every episode of that series. And we hadn't achieved, you know, it's an ongoing process.
Yep.
We got to the end of series 1 of Dilemma and realised the episodes that were 3 men weren't quite as good as the episodes with 2 men and 2 women. And then thinking about that and then going, well, the thing with Dilemma is it's a moral and ethical problem put in front of people to kick about.
Yep.
So if people share a background, they're less likely to disagree, and that makes a less interesting show.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you've got people with different experiences, they might have different morals. And even if they do agree, I think if you put like the 27-year-old British Nigerian actress Kush Jumbo next to the 57-year-old son of the Chancellor of Exchequer, Sunday Telegraph editor Dominic Lawson, if they agree, that's interesting. But if they disagree and talk about it, that's also interesting. And so you get to this thing where, as I said in the blog post, that it makes it funnier.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it a better show. And then once you realise that comedy is about surprise, because punchlines should be the least logical thing. So the correct response to My Dog's Got No Nose, the correct understanding, on a very basic level, the correct understanding of my dog's got no nose is to say, oh, how does he smell?
Yeah.
That is obviously the verb of sniffing. That's pretty obvious, understood thing.
Yes.
And so terrible is the least logical answer, but it's still a logical answer. And on that level, comedy is about surprise. And therefore, if you have someone who is a white middle-aged man like me telling jokes, what I don't want is another 37-year-old white man telling jokes before me, because our viewpoints are likely to be similar and our jokes therefore likely to be similar. What you want is, you know, someone who isn't white, someone who isn't 37, someone who isn't a man, someone who isn't straight, someone who doesn't live in the south of England. You know, you want different viewpoints because that increases the surprise. I have noticed improvement in recent years. I don't know if it's fixed. You know, if we're on a smooth train to full equality and full representation, because, I mean, to take disability as an example, it's very hard for disabled people to do radio the way that radio comedy is made. If you are blind or visually impaired, I don't know how to make a Braille script. I mean, I genuinely don't.
Okay.
That's never come up. It's never, I don't even know how I would start. I'm sure I could work it out. If you're in a wheelchair, the radio theatre stage is largely inaccessible. Like, just literally getting on stage, you have to think about that. I worked with Kerry Bunnell from CBeebies, who, whose arm ends at the elbow. And suddenly realised, how are you going to turn your script? And she ended up sharing a script with another actor she was in her scenes with. And that's just not a thing that ever gets thought about because of the amount of money, the amount of time in radio production. In terms of gender, I think radio is the best place to be. You know, you only have to look at, I mean, who's your favourite lesbian panel show host whose name starts with S? Because you got Susan Carman on Mr. Mania, Sue Perkins on Dilemma, Sandy Toksui on Newsgris. That's probably a bad example because all those shows are finished. But Susan's still on the network, Sue's still on the network, Sandy's doing stuff, Bridget Christie's doing stuff, Sarah Pascoe's got a show.
She's amazing.
Jocelyn Jessian's got a show.
Daniel Ward should be on a lot more.
Daniel's amazing.
Please,
We try. So I think, and the fact is that ever since I've been doing radio comedy, which was since 2002, there's been a female head of BBC Radio Comedy since 2009. There's Jane Batu followed by Julie McKenzie. There's been a female commissioning editor, Caroline Fayal, followed by Seanad William. So we're coming up on 20 years of female commissioning editors for comedy, apart from 1 year period where Paul Mayhew Archer sat in for Caroline. We've had a female controller of Radio 4 when I started. Helen Bowden was the controller. Then Mark Damaser did, I think, 5 years. And then now Gwyneth William. There are a lot of women in positions of authority, and I think that probably helps move women up. That's why in radio there are so many funny women.
Hooray for funny women.
There's loads of them, it turns out. I've done a graph. It's not perfect in terms of race, to put it mildly, but compared to TV, you know, on radio, Lenny Henry has Rogue's Gallery, Stephen K. Amos is in his third series, What's the Case Stand For? Nish Kumar's got a show coming up and he hosted Newsjack, and Ramesh Ranganathan's got a pilot going out and
he's very cheeky.
Did Newsjack, Jocelyn again, Nathan Caton had 3 series, Lem Sisse I do stuff with. Radio 4 is more open to diverse voices than I think it's sometimes given credit for.
Absolutely.
I think the self-selecting audience of people interested in intelligent speech, which is I think how they define their audience, are increasingly open to different voices.
Yeah.
I mean, Gwyneth William, who is the controller of Radio 4, came to the Radio 4 from the World Service, and I think that really helped. I think she commissioned A Beginner's Guide to Pakistan from Sammy, and definitely A Beginner's Guide to India from Aditi. And I think, you know, she's keen, I think Radio 4 listeners are keen to not just have a British view on things, but have a bit wider. I think they want the widest possible views on things.
And so
I think there's no novelty value in diversity. But if you have an interesting thing to say, diversity, your ethnicity isn't going to hold you back on Radio 4. But I think it's about having that interesting thing to say. Now, obviously, that having an interesting thing to say is qualified by who gets to decide what's interesting. So I think there is that there's still some there would be a structural issue there, but I think Radio 4 is probably the most open place for, you know, non-white, non-male comedy voices I can think of.
I mean, just back to your producer's role, how much impact do you have on everything from the time that it's been commissioned as a script to it being performed? Do you help with casting? Do you decide on musically what happens? I mean, what exactly is the nitty-gritty of the role of producer from moment of commission onwards?
Right, so when I got my job, I phoned my mum.
Right.
And said, I've got this job as a trainee producer. And she said, oh, do you have to come up with the ideas? And I was like, no. And she said, oh, you don't write it then either. It was like, no, don't write it, write it. She went, and you definitely don't perform? No. All right, do you record it? No. That's, we have engineers. All right, do you edit it afterwards? No. And mum paused and went, so a producer doesn't actually do anything. And I'm not sure she's wrong. But what you're responsible for is the team. And with Souvenir Programme, John already had a show, Cabin Pressure, which was some established actors and John.
Yes.
Roger, Benedict and Stephanie all, you know, as John has said, could open a show at the National, even pre-Sherlock. You know, that's a respectable cast. So John gets absolutely to fit in as the cabin idiot. And because that was on air, we decided we didn't want to pitch John and some actors. Mm-hmm. We wanted to pitch John and friends. So that casting was, which comedians, which comic actors do you want to write for in sketches?
Fantastic.
Who do you know well enough that you know you can write for their strength? And the original cast list was, we put down in the offer, we said, these are the people we want in it. We want Simon, Laurie and Carrie.
Right.
Because we were only pitching for four because we didn't think it would be successful enough for six. And then after series one, and we went up to six episodes, and we realised that John was going to have to write a lot more female parts.
Yeah.
Because over 4.5 hours, Carrie could do everything. And then we were like, well, what if we wanted two women in a sketch? I know, imagine such
dun,
a thing.
Dun, dun.
And we're like, well, who's your next favourite person you like writing for? And he went, well, are we allowed Margaret?
Yeah.
Yes. So we had Margaret in. In terms of the casting for a sitcom,
yeah,
for the main parts, I think you'd need the agreement of the writer. Because I think, as I said, it's about the team. That's what the producer does. So you're trying to marry the idea, whether that's a panel show with a panel or a sitcom with a cast.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're trying to marry what the writer wants to do with sort of the practical logistics,
yes,
of getting it made,
yep,
in terms of budget and availability and everything else. So Welcome to Our Village was always Catherine Parkinson.
Mm-hmm.
That we always thought,
amazing.
Catherine Parkinson.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's fantastic.
Yeah.
And we always thought, right, Catherine Parkinson is our ideal Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we came to make it, the pilot in 2011, we asked Catherine Parkinson. And she said yes. And that made the rest of the casting quite easy because it's on Radio 2 and it's got Catherine Parkinson in, and that sort of confers a certain amount of...
Yes.
Bit of oh, she, well, she thinks it's good. Weirdly, the last person to be cast, because I couldn't think who fitted. It took me ages to find an Ulyaban that Eddie and I agreed on.
Yeah.
That hit the right tone. And as soon as, I think Eddie said Julian Ryan Tutt, it was like... That's who I should have thought of a month ago.
Yeah.
That's, yeah. Yes, yes. So we'd been through, but in terms of, I think, three of the parts, we went back and forth, me and Eddie, saying, do you think that so-and-so is right for this?
Yep. And that was just a verbal thing? I mean, did you get them in for readings?
You normally can't get anyone in for reading for radio because the money isn't good enough for them to come and be rejected. I've done one audition, no, two auditions in my life. One was for a local radio thing, and it was for people who basically weren't professional actors. So we did do some readings in Leeds for that, for a local radio thing in 2004-05. The other one was for a sitcom I did called Living with the Enemy, where the third lead, it was co-written and co-starring Giles Brandreth and Nick Revel.
Oh, bless, yeah.
Together at last. and actually, it was a really good series.
Yeah.
But the third lead was, in the story, Giles's goddaughter, who was the daughter of some unsavoury, basically, dictator in Africa, who there'd been a coup, and she'd been cut off. And Giles is the only person in London she knows.
Right.
And the thing on the radio, that you can do colourblind casting. we were aware at some point there would be a photo, and we decided it was she was probably West African, but Swiss educated and Paris, and, you know, we decided she was going to be played with a French accent, basically.
Hello.
So really, anyone could do a French accent. It would have been fine. But we were aware there were probably going to be cast photos. Uh-huh. So I was going, right, why is this actor white?
Yeah.
And we thought we better do some auditions, because if it turns out the best person is white, then we can justify it, more or less. But we auditioned, and the person we found through it was Gugu Mbatha-Raw.
Okay.
Who was, if you've seen Belle, the film, she's fantastic in that. Perhaps she's in the new... she's doing Black Mirror. She's done the new Black Mirror. She's doing the new Star Wars. And that's the only time. And in terms of... Because all the people we saw were professional actors, we knew they'd do a good read.
Yeah.
Actually, what it became about was... Most people haven't done radio.
So what would you recommend any actors who want to potentially get involved in this? Is it only through agents that you would employ people?
Not necessarily through agents. I mean, I do get people emailing me voice clips and I listen to them and sort of file them away for future reference. I don't know, it is hard. I met with an agent, a voiceover agent, who we don't normally deal with. We normally deal with acting agents for radio. And she was saying she just found it very hard because there are loads of really talented people that she just can't, you know, was struggling to get producers to use, and they were doing sort of lots of very good voiceover work, and somehow the progression wasn't moving as smoothly. And I think, you know, to take something as, you know, like Welcome to Our Village would be an example. You have the sort of lead parts where you're looking to cast that person who gets you some attention. The profile person, the lead, and I think everyone understands that. And then often we work with a lot of the same people because they're people I can throw a script to at 2 o'clock on the day of recording and know they'll get it right.
Yeah.
I just don't have to worry about it.
Yes.
I think radio drama are a lot more proactive. BBC radio drama. I worked with them a bit before I left. I was on the radio drama company committee. I don't know, do you know the radio drama company?
Yes. Yeah.
Right, so you know, you get a 3-month contract or 6-month contract, and then you're just on call every day. And comedy makes use of them. We used to make use of them, doesn't anymore. I think since they've gone indie. You know, they do a competition every year.
Yes.
A couple of them, actually. There's
there's a few on the website that they reference. Yeah.
Yeah, but also one thing they're very good at is, because they're constantly looking for new voices, is that obviously in comedy the new voices come through because if Tez Elias has a show, it's going to sound like Tez Elias. It's not going to sound like anyone else. And if Mae Martin has a show, it's going to sound like Mae Martin. Whereas in radio, they're looking for new performers, probably going to go back to classic works every 7 to 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they run workshops. They actually, you know, if people have submitted voice reels that are decent, they'll say, come in, we'll work with you.
Yeah.
And then that voice reel gets circulated amongst drama producers who are always looking for people who are new and therefore cheap and keen. And yeah, they will... They will try people out in small roles. If you can do a couple of different accents really well, that's invaluable because you can be in the same play 3 times.
Yes.
I used an actor, Chris Jack, who was in Show What You Wrote. I was looking for that person who I could throw a script to at 2 o'clock and know that it would be fine. But it was recording in Manchester. Most of the actors I know live in London and the southeast. So I asked Radio Drama, so who would you recommend, who's come up? And they said, well, Chris Jack recorded this thing, and they showed me his reel, and it was like, oh yeah, no, he's really good.
Yeah.
They vouched for him because they'd got him into a studio.
Yeah.
And he could do 3 or 4 different accents, so it's
great.
Well,
so there's hope.
I'd never worked with him before. I don't know how much radio he's done, but he was really good. And it was I think down to radio dramas, again, cynical or uncynical, it doesn't really matter, but they will get new people and they will run workshops. If you have a half decent voice reel, send it to them and say you want to do radio drama, because
You never know. It could happen. Awesome. Yeah, I'll do that tomorrow. Right. with regards to obviously your vast experience, are there any rookie mistakes that you think back and think, oh, if I shouldn't have done that, or I wish I hadn't done that?
Don't get too drunk at Christmas parties, I suppose. Although that's a mistake I continue to make.
Yes, you've been doing that for years.
Yeah. Oh God. So I just remembered I once threw up in your parents' pond.
I did hold your hair back. It was fine.
Yeah. Actually, no, it wasn't your parents' pond. It was your, Eddie's.
It was Ed and Claire's.
You'll cut that out.
I don't know.
I was 17. You were breaking the law. You shouldn't have given me the booze. I think, as a producer, I'm not sure if they were mistakes. I think at the start of my career, I took quite a purist attitude towards embellishing my shows. I used sound effects sparsely.
Right.
I didn't use music. And my panel shows were short versions of the recordings.
Right.
As I've gone on, I'll tell you one story about Dilemma that really informed how I edit panel shows, which was in series two, we did a recording that was, it was on Lem Sissay, Margaret Cameron Smith, Paul Sinha, Kennedy, we work with the same people all the time, and Graham Garden.
Yeah, amazing.
And Graham's dilemma for the first round was, would you accept a permanent secure funding for the BBC if it meant that you personally could only ever watch ITV1? And he said, well, the BBC's been very good to me. So he said, no, I'll take that hit. And they went, well, what about all the, you know, Attenborough? You won't get any more Attenborough. He said, well, the thing is, Sue, you know, if the BBC have a hit, ITV copy it, you know. So BBC has Attenborough, ITV has Splash with Tom Daly. It's the same show. And then Sue, and because the way the show worked is that Sue asks a binary question, yes or no, and then has a list of yes and a list of no. And she just turns to the right page and she goes down. And so the panellists knew what their dilemma was. Right? Yeah. We tell them in advance what their dilemma is because we know that won't help them beyond the first 30 seconds. They've just thought around the subject. They'll say yes or no, and then we'll make them change their mind. They don't see any other of our persuasive techniques. And so Sue said, what about Scandi Noir? What about, you know, your Killings, your Borgans on BBC Four?
Yeah.
And Graham said, well, I'll just watch Emmerdale with the lights off. I guess so quickly. It was like we told him we were going to do that. We definitely hadn't. And there was this sort of longueur on the recording as there's such a big laugh. And afterwards, I heard from all three other panellists afterwards that they couldn't think of anything to say for a minute. All they could think of was, I'm never going to say anything that funny rest of my life. And then when I was in the edit and I was sort of trying to pick out, there were a couple of things Lem, because obviously that was all Graham, and I wanted to include other voices on every question.
Mm.
And Lem had said something interesting, and I think Margaret said a nice thing. And I say, well, after that joke, you don't want to hear anything. You want to move on. That's ended the conversation.
Yeah.
And I worked out a way of taking the three little comments and sticking them before.
Okay.
And ending on the biggest laugh.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, if I can do that here, I can do that for every question. So from then on, every round, every question on Dilemma ended on the biggest laugh.
Right.
Before we moved on.
And no matter where it comes.
If there's something interesting after it, just move it before. Find a way of moving it before.
Yep.
And if you can't, cut it, even though it's interesting. Because you're never going to fit in everything you want to anyway.
Mm-hmm.
With Souvenir Programme, I think we were very determined we didn't want to use stings. John and I don't like stings. Lots of people do. Dead Ringers use them all the time.
Yes.
Newsjack, throw them in all the time.
Yep.
They are a useful device sometimes if you need to demark stuff. But we wanted to make a show that flowed. We wanted not to do that. And that's where previously, where I wouldn't have used music or wouldn't have used stings, we just thought, well, if we're introducing a sketch that's set in Greece, let's edge up under the applause between each sketch. Let's just edge up a bit of Greek music and fade it down.
Mm-hmm.
Voltaire sketch in series one. Some French music. I was going to use accordion, and then I googled it, and it turns out the accordion was invented after Voltaire died, so we didn't use accordion.
Research.
Yeah.
They were paying you to do stuff, and you did it. Good work.
No, it's just we're really, really fussy. There was John, Romulus and Remus sketch in the first series, where he'd written Romulus is on the phone to his mother because Remus is trying to set up Reem, and you know, you've had such success with Rome, why don't you help him?
Yeah.
And he's going, it's not going to work, Mum. It's not going to work because he's not allowed enough time to do it. I mean, Rome wasn't built in it. Yes. So you keep saying, and awesome. It's all the cliches. And one of the jokes is, it's not going to be better just because it's on Seven Hills. And I was like, but Rome's on Seven Hills.
Mm-hmm.
And is it? Oh, I'm pretty sure Rome's on Seven Hills, so you have to change that to eight. And we had to look it up
because
otherwise the joke doesn't make any sense. I think all comedy is based on a sort of truth, based on honesty. And so if that honesty is Milton Jones's I'm coming out and all this is nonsense, or Tim Vine, these are just puns, you can sort of embrace that. Whereas if it's the honesty of here are some political views, those have to be sincerely held. And I think there's a sort of honesty in, if we are going to mock the idea of Reem being better than Rome, you have to know about Rome.
Yep.
Yeah. Otherwise, and it's sort of, it's incredibly minor, but that irritating. In fact, there's a very funny story, if I do say so myself, about the pilot of Souvenir Programme, which is called John Fenimore, apparently, which went out in 2008.
Yes.
And my dad came to it.
Oh.
My dad used to come to all my recordings. The year he died. And he came along and we did a sketch that we did later. We did it in series one, which was a murder mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a man being found dead in a cottage. All the doors were locked from the inside.
Yeah.
All the windows were locked shut, didn't open, and were made of brick.
Yeah.
And they had to break their way in. And there was a joke about someone answering a crossword clue.
Mm-hmm.
9-letter word for inachievable.
Okay.
And then later on in the sketch, the maid says, impossible. Well, mm-hmm. It's a 9-letter word for unachievable. And then at the end of the sketch, when they've revealed the maid is the murderer,
yep.
This is badly, badly compressing this sketch, which I could do verbatim. John says, as Finnemore, the storyteller, you know, they do say that all master criminals make one major mistake. She was no different. What is it? Impossible is not a 9-letter word. Good night. And Dad came backstage afterwards and said, impossible is a 9-letter word. I-M-P-O-S-S-I-B-L-E. Oh, 10-letter word. It's a 10-letter word for unachievable. I've got this wrong because we corrected it. It's a 10-letter word for unachievable. And Dad said, it is a 10-letter word. And me and Tom Goodman Hill, who was in the pilot, we went, oh, yeah, that's the joke. Because they've hung her for what he sees as the mistake, but it's not a mistake, so it's an extra joke.
Yeah.
And John had just gone pale and gone, oh, is it, no, oh, did I get that? I've got it wrong. Is it 10 letters? It should have been, oh, no. And it turns out John had planned an entirely different joke. So I couldn't use that sketch in the pilot. We ended up using it in the first series with the correct number of letters. So I think you have to fact check that.
Mm-hmm. Anyway,
to go back to production, I think as I've gone on, I've become more aware of, I think this probably isn't uncommon, and this was subconscious. I think I thought using music was cheating.
Right.
I mean, you've all seen those, like, moving film scenes where the music's taken out and they don't work as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I must have thought that, oh, well, they're just reacting to the stings or they're just reacting to the effects. And I thought if it didn't make it funnier, don't put it in and be quite true to the recordings. And I think as I've gone on, I've thought more and more about the listener at home.
Yeah.
Because once you start associating the timeline and the effects on recordings, only put in the effects that work,
mm-hmm.
but there is this bigger audience and you can reward them with extra jokes. So the Since You Ask Me is in Souvenir Programme, most of those effects aren't heard by the audience.
Right.
We did one series before last where he crossed the Atlantic by horseback and pretty much none of that was there.
Wow.
Including an extra joke that was added by Rich Evans, the editor,
mm-hmm.
and it's house style for the show now, which is when John mentions a mode of transport, it makes a noise.
The noise, perfect.
So the HMS Indomitable,
mm-hmm.
and then later on he says the name again, and Rich put the funnel horn in again, which involved like an edit because mm-hmm. John carried on in real life,
right.
But Rich cut and moved, spaced it out so you could hear the thing again. And we just decided, every time her name is said,
perfect,
she makes a noise. And then every time he mentions his two-seater, yeah. And
so it's a sound version of the hippopotamus mother-in-law.
We do a sort of proper phony job of, like, playing along at home.
Uh-huh.
And some people don't like it. I did some sound effect work on the first series of Balls in Our History Revision. Got a very angry email saying, silence is one of the most powerful tools at a radio producer's disposal.
Wow, well, that told you.
Yeah, but I think the more you realise there are two audiences and the more you realise that the recordings and the programmes are two separate things and you have to make a good night, but the atmosphere often doesn't translate or, you don't have time for everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to undergo some form of transformation between mm-hmm. what you've recorded and what you're going to broadcast.
Yep.
Once you embrace that, you start thinking, well, what will really reward the listener? Make your shows as rich as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Think about what the audience is getting. There's a sketch in the last series of Souvenir Programme,
mm-hmm.
a sketch which is based around the idea of imperators in the Roman Empire had slaves to whisper, remember you are but a man, in their ear.
Yeah.
Right. And the sketch is just about how annoying that would get. Right, that's it. But it opens with this stirring speech mm-hmm. from Simon. Tomorrow we return to Rome. And we try to make it sound like the aftermath of a battle, like in Gladiator, you know, when they're yeah. in the northern woods, and nothing sounds like that.
No.
And so I thought, well, let's do some gladiatory music, because that sets a tone. And if you hear that string and da, da, and centurions, prepare, you know, you sort of immediately know where you are.
Mm.
And a lot of sound effects, well, we've done jokes about it on Souvenir Programme, where we did a sketch that started with ding, ding, good morning, sir. Seriously, John? Ding, ding, good morning, sir. That's how you're starting a sketch? Yeah. There are shorthands, and it's about understanding what your audience's shorthands are.
Mm-hmm.
If a certain piece of music makes you feel a certain way, chances are it's going to make your audience feel a certain way.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be the cliched, obvious tracks that everyone uses, but just think sort of instrumentation, tone, rhythm, volume, all those things. You can make your audience think of something.
Mm-hmm.
So I think as I've gone on in my career, I think that's the thing I've realised, that A, dissociate your recordings and your broadcasts,
mm-hmm.
but also it's not cheating to use sound effects
mm-hmm.
and music. It doesn't automatically make it better. But if you think it does make it better, then you shouldn't shy away from it on principle.
Fantastic. With regards to how you've got these jobs, I mean, you know, you talked a little bit about the Hancocks, which is obviously a massive thing, I think. Was it a daunting prospect to be the producer of such an important series?
It was Neil Pearson's idea.
Okay.
And he gave it to Steve Canny, who was a producer, an executive producer in radio comedy. And then Steve Canny left, because his wife and child lived in Scotland, so he went to get a job in Scotland.
Oh, well, I don't blame
which
him.
Was sort of
it's a lovely place to live.
A relatively sensible thing to do. and so they were looking for someone to produce it. And they, you know, Neil had not produced before, so it needed to be someone relatively experienced. And looking at the schedules, they gave it to me, which was, you know, they asked, have you got enough time to do it? And I went, yes, because it's booking some actors in the radio theatre. The scripts do not need work.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I think actually the confines of that project, because every project, you know, you've sold an idea.
Yeah.
Sinha, what we have to do is tell the audience funny, interesting stories that either they never knew or tell them they're wrong. About what they thought they knew. Like, who was the first person to circumnavigate the planet? Because people say Ferdinand Magellan.
Okay.
It wasn't him. He died halfway round. So it was actually his second in command.
Right.
Juan something Elcado, I think. I can't remember. It was a series and a half ago. So every programme has confines. One of the most open shows is Souvenir Programme, because it's sketches that John wrote. That's the remit to get in that show.
Yeah.
Welcome to Our Village had to be about a woman who wants to escape from an alien-held village and no one's that bothered. Every episode is about that.
Yeah.
And that's your constraints. If it's not about that, then what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
With the Hancocks, it was incredibly simple because the scripts are there.
Yeah.
We can't add to them.
Mm-hmm.
We can't change them. In fact, we did change one thing.
Sacrilege.
Well, no, we asked permission.
Yes.
And we got
it. I was going to say, was there some kind of estate over your shoulder giving you...
It was Ray and Alan. It's not an estate, it's the late Alan, so we say, but it was Ray and Alan, their manager, Tessa. And in fact, Ray and Alan completely got it and said, if there's anything else you need to change, that, you know, like that, don't worry about it. And you know, it was like, it's literally that one line in three series, I think, now
that we've had to
change. And because you've got the script, all you have to do is execute the script. And so we very quickly, I don't think Kevin McNally was attached before I got involved. I think it was a conversation like, who do we want to do this, who can do it? He was sort of the only name, really. I don't remember if there was anyone else even up for discussion. Because we knew he was a big fan and did Neil knew him somehow. Kevin Eldon, I've made Kevin Eldon do an Australian accent before, and I know that it came out pretty close to Bill Kerr. So he was quite easy to get on board.
Yeah.
Robin Sebastian is a sort of semi-professional Kenneth Williams impersonator. So the casting came together. I mean, the hardest one, as he himself has said, doing Sid James.
Yeah.
Sid James is very, very hard to do because it's a South African East End Jew. And that sort of... that's quite distinct. Also, yeah. The one I think everyone remembers is the Carry On voice, which was several thousand cigarettes down the line from where he was in Hancock.
Interesting, yeah, yeah.
But the thing was, because like if you listen to Kevin McNally doing Hancock and then you listen to Hancock, Kevin's a little bit higher.
Uh-huh.
He's a little bit quicker. I think the delivery is a little bit quicker all round, really, or whether that's just us editing.
Right.
But what he absolutely nails is the tone and definitely. The stress and the rhythm of it. I'd say a little bit quicker, but the rhythm of delivery is what he gets. And obviously Kevin doing Bill is just the Australian accent. It's close enough. It's not an impression show.
Sure,
and
that's interesting.
What Simon got was the tone of Sid James. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not a bad voice. It's just not. It's not an impression because he just. And so, once we accepted that actually it's not an impression show, the show has to work as a script. Because you couldn't hear it, you couldn't go back and listen and go, "This is how it should have been done." You could have got impressionists to do that.
Yeah.
Because they could have gone, this sound, this sound, this sound, this sound, and we're going to copy.
Yeah.
We couldn't do that. We don't know how they delivered them. We've just done series three. There's a couple of episodes where Tony Hancock didn't turn up and Harry Secombe stood in.
Yeah.
And we've got Harry Secombe's son, Andy, doing
Fantastic.
It.
Fantastic, yeah.
And he doesn't know how his dad did it. Did he try to be like Hancock?
Right.
I mean, in that first script, we've got the script.
Yeah.
It's Tony.
Yeah.
Everyone calls him Tony. He's on the page as Tony. Yes. He's called Tub. There's no jokes about him being hairy.
Yeah.
As the next two shows went on, there's jokes about him being short and Welsh. But that first script, was he trying to be Hancock? Did he do it just as Neddy Seagoon? We don't know.
Nobody knows. Can tell you. Yes.
And so we have to find a way to make the scripts work. And you can only do that if you've got good character actors who can play the parts.
Yeah.
And that was more important. We figured that if you've just got people who sound like them but can't get to that character, that's a less satisfying show than people who can get to that character but sound a bit off or aren't exactly, you know. I'm not sure before I started listening back for this, I could have told you what Andre Melly sounded like.
Right. Wow. Okay.
But then I went and found some and it was like, all right, Susie Kane. Sounds like Susie Kane. That sort of weird DH for a T.
Lovely times. But yeah, and did you use actual Foley? Live Foley?
Yes. But we had people on stage actually. My favourite sound effect in series two, there's a sound effect where he says, "Let me open a bottle," and all the sound effects we had on Drive. So it was a mix of live stuff and obviously sound effects.
Yeah.
They would have played in on a reel-to-reel. We play on a computer.
Yeah.
Aside from that, it's, you know, they're not actually going to have an aeroplane.
Sure.
They would have done that off a disc.
Yeah.
So some things you're always going to cheat. But in terms of having someone on stage, there was this cue to open a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And the Marriage Bureau, series two. And if you go back and listen to our recording, there's a really big laugh. Because what had happened is we'd been through all the effects and none of them sounded, I wasn't happy with any of them.
Yep.
It was a single recording day, so we had loads of time. And I went to Nicholas Wine Store on Great Portland Street and bought four bottles of tonic water.
Because
I was looking for little bottles of Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't find any anywhere on Great Portland Street. And then I found tonic water and I was like, that'll work. I bought four because I figured rehearsals and stuff.
Yeah.
And then our sound engineer in rehearsal opened it. And it made sort of a noise, but it wasn't great. And I was like, "Do you want to try shaking it more?" And he was like, no, we'll do it on the night and I'll shake it more. But if, you don't want it too big and you can always enhance it in the edit. And I said, all right, fine. And so out of the four bottles, he used one and it didn't sound great. And then on the night, basically, as soon as he'd finished the effects cue before then, he started shaking this bottle in full view of the audience. I don't know why I looked to where he would look to the audience as a great audio ed. And he was just shaking it for about 90 seconds.
Uh-huh.
And then he came out, "Let me open a bottle." And he opened it. And of course, he just fizzed everywhere. It was a huge sound. And he realised he had a split second to save either his computer or his script.
Oh.
And he decided to sacrifice his script for absolutely the right decision. But there's this huge laugh. And I sort of left it in as a tribute to that. Because for a second, I mean, actually shorter than it was, but there's this big laugh because he has just emptied a bottle of tonic water all over the radio theatre stage.
Marvellous.
There are some shows. I mean, the first series of Bleak Expectations had live effects on stage.
Yes.
I remember the peacock, seeing a peacock for the first time, which is in radio, is a umbrella.
Yes.
It's being flapped. It's absolutely fantastic. Unfortunately, it's a budgetary thing because it's an extra sound engineer most of the time, and it's an extra sound engineer for a sort of 6-8 hour day.
Mm-hmm.
So most people just sort of don't figure the cost is worth the payoff with the missing Hancocks, because part of it was to recreate it faithfully.
Yes.
I mean, down to the fact that we wore suits and ties.
Oh, good job.
Yeah,
marvellous.
Properly dressed up, and Susie and Margaret in their twin set and pearls. We figured that there was added value to the fact that this was not how we normally do things nowadays. It was a bit more of a throwback, and challenges you. How would they have done that sound effect? Rather than just search on a computer and bring up a wire, you have to actually go, well, if he's going to drop a load of baskets, we've got a load of baskets downstairs. Let's pick them up and throw them on the floor and see what that sounds like.
Yes, yes.
Anyone who's been playing with sound effects since childhood, though, which my family were, you know, we very quickly learnt from our trying to recreate our Goon Show script book that a sock full of custard does not sound like a sock full of custard.
Fair enough.
And it's not. You want to put your hand into a beaker of custard.
I was wondering what you're going to say.
Yeah, hand into a beaker of custard, and it makes the squelch.
Right.
Whereas filling a sock full of custard and hitting the floor with it will just get custard everywhere, and your mum will be furious. Do not do that.
Wonderful top tip.
Yeah.
And just to finish off, really, is there anything that you'd say to encourage people who are thinking about going into producing audio comedy?
Oh, God, don't do that. That's, I've got a mortgage. I think in terms of every layer of comedy, you really have to want to do it. You, to write, to perform, to do stand-up, I think is, you know, people go to Edinburgh and lose thousands and thousands of pounds. And if you are expecting a career off the back of it, you might end up very frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
So do things you're proud of, and do things that you want to do.
Yeah.
Because that's, you know, if it's a success, great. If it's not, that's fine. On the Comedian's Comedian podcast, Mitch Benn was asked.
Him.
Yeah, we used
He's
to...
He's been around a while.
Yeah, I've got a photo of...
97, yeah.
We used to get, we saw his show a couple of times.
Yeah.
They did a double header with Adam Bloom, I think.
Yes, that sounds ominous.
He said, he was asked if he'd ever written something that he wasn't that into, you know, because he thought the audience would like it. And he said, I have, and it didn't work. And what he decided is that if I like it, if I like what I'm doing, then at least that's one person in the world.
Mm-hmm.
How awful would it be to make something that nobody in the world likes? If I made something that I didn't like, there's a chance that no one else would like it either.
Yeah.
And so I think if you have to be sincere, I think all my programmes are the best. And that's partly sort of stock arrogance on my part. But also because I've realised that I think you have to be an enthusiast. I think you have to be into it. When I did the Newscast, I did the Newscast for 2 years in 2007, 2008.
Oh, that's a great show, yeah.
With Sandy, I started on Sandy's second series. I saw the show through the death of Alan Corrin. That happened while under my watch. And while I was doing the news quiz, I thought it was the best topical on radio because it wasn't, you know, scripted. It was free-flowing, great rotation of guests, introduced some new people like Carrie and Hugo Rifkin and Simon Evans. And put some new voices in.
Yeah.
But I still got to use Francis Ween and Andy Hamilton, Jeremy Hardy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, you know...
So your childhood heroes too.
Yeah. I never thought when I was listening to the Mark Steele Solution Radio 5 when I was 15, 16, I never thought I'd have my own office in Broadcasting House. And Mark Steele would be stood at the door and I'd be turning to him going, for God's sake, Mark, I'm trying to work. That was very much his way of writing his lectures, of just wandering around the office and talking to people and being ran out of people to talk to.
It was a good way of doing it. Obviously,
worked. Eventually, won awards and everything. And then I stopped doing that and did The Now Show, and I became convinced that The Now Show was the best topical, because it wasn't just this random juntering by four panellists. It's honed and scripted, and you get polemics by people like Marcus Brigstocke and Ben Goldacre did a particularly good one, I remember. And then I started doing Newsjack, and I became convinced that Newsjack was the best one, because I get to steer the sketches, and you know, and clearly not all of that is true, but I think it's important to believe it at the time. I got nominated for Entertainment Producer of the Year at the Radio Production Awards.
Fantastic, yes.
Which you have to nominate yourself for.
Okay.
I'm writing about yourself in the third person form, and it's very self-aggrandizing and awkward if you're English. But I did it anyway because uh-huh. it looks good on a CV. And I was talking to another producer, and neither of us had won. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about that and
it's rigged.
How we feel. Yeah, clearly. Yep. David Tyler, what's he know? But I just thought, actually, do you know what? I think my shows are the best.
Mm-hmm.
But I think everyone else, every other producer on that shortlist, the other four producers, they should all think that too.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're in charge of it. I think the newscast was best when I was in charge of it because I got to choose who was on and what questions got asked and what stayed in the edit.
Yep.
So it's obvious that that was all to my taste because there isn't time on the newscast to ask anyone else what they think.
Yeah.
You just have to go, that makes me laugh. It might make the audience laugh. I'm not cleverer or funnier than the audience.
Yep.
So if it makes me laugh, they'll probably make them laugh too. I sort of tried to institute that rule on the Now show as well. So if someone changed something in rehearsal and it made the whole room laugh, well, let's leave that in. That's going to make the audience laugh too.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, love what you do because it's really hard to get a show.
Mm.
It took 3 years to get a souvenir programme on air from the pilot.
Wow.
We did the pilot in 2008. We didn't get a series until 2011.
Okay.
Paul Sinha and I did we pitched our first show at the start of 2011, mm-hmm. we pitched a four-part series. We got 1.5 hour in 2011.
Wow.
We got 1.5 hour in 2012.
Okay.
We got 4.5 hours in 2013.
Wow.
It's not quick.
Mm. But why is that? Why? How can that happen?
Because Paul had never done a half hour before.
Okay.
And because the idea we put in had not appealed to the people, actually in the department, it wasn't Radio 4 or anything, they saw it. The Resistance, which became Welcome to Our Village, was pitched to Radio 4. 6 months they turned it down. They just bought My First Planet, another sci-fi. So they didn't feel they could fit any more in. And then a slot came up on radio. That was 2010. I think my first email about it was 2009. Then a slot came up in a pilot season in 2011. So we got a pilot, and then we had to make a series in 2012.
Wow.
You know, these things take a long time.
Yeah.
Even if they're good. Souvenir, you know, John Finnemore feels like it was the easiest commission in Radio 4 history, and it wasn't because there's no hook to it. There's no famous people in it.
Mm.
It's just, this is a really good sketch show. Now it's on, it would be quite hard to take it off.
Mm-hmm.
As long as it maintains its quality.
Yeah.
Because people like it.
Yep.
But we had to get in front of people to know people like it.
Yeah.
One of the exciting things about the online world is if your audience can find you,
yeah,
then you have a thing you can take to broadcasters and go, people like this, and
yep.
we know they like this. Whereas working in-house at the BBC with the various strictures that there were on in-house production, you can't give your programmes away and you can't sell them anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
I did a pilot in 2007,
mm-hmm.
written by Kevin Eldon,
mm-hmm.
starring Kevin Eldon, Simon Munnery, Phil Cornwall, Julia Davis and Amelia Bulmore.
Wow, what a cast.
It's called The Thing Show. It's one of the best things I've ever made.
Yeah.
And it didn't get bought, so no one's ever going to hear it. It's just
travesty.
Really good. Yeah, most of the material Kevin's used in Kevin Eldon Will See You Now.
Okay,
so
yeah.
It's not a, you know, it's not
all
a write-off,
yes.
But it was a really good show and it's never going to be heard anywhere. Whereas if we'd done it as a podcast,
mm-hmm.
people would have heard it.
Yeah.
And if enough people had liked it, then you could go to a broadcast and go, we've got this audience. I think that's a sort of change in the dynamic that people are allowed to become successful elsewhere and then they're bringing that. I mean, you see it mostly with BBC Three with stuff like Hood Documentary and Knack in Saltfish and even People Just Do Nothing. That.
Yes,
these
a rolling ball of
found
an publicity.
Mm. And they were like, well, if you want to get access to our audience.
Mm. I mean, just for example, I mean, there's a, I don't know if you've heard of it, a sitcom that I absolutely love called Wooden Overcoats. And
yes.
That's been, you know, extremely successful and popular, you know, not just in this country, but across the pond and so on. And so how, for example, could that kind of show pitch well to get commissioned?
I think that it's about... So if you see what Welcome to Night Vale have done.
Yeah.
So they've got Welcome to Night Vale, and that's hugely successful. And I checked, by the way, that I thought I'd subconsciously nicked Welcome to Our Village, Please Invade Carefully's title.
Right.
From that. Turns out we recorded our pilot under the new title 2 days before they launched. So we're
so
absolutely in the clear. Like, literally like, Googling into the early hours trying to make sure I'm in the clear. But if you look at what they've done, I think it's really interesting because they've built this audience through doing their own thing. It's a huge audience. I went to the Union Chapel to see their live show. It's like 900 people who paid 25 quid a head.
Yeah.
All of them, well, a vast majority of them, university-age women and younger.
Right.
And they were paying £25 to effectively see a radio recording. They were holding scripts, the music was being played over.
Yep.
And there was, you know, live music as well, but I did wonder how many of them knew you could go and see this sort of thing at the Radio Theatre most days of the week. And then if they do know that, is there something that's putting them off? Is it the lack of diverse casting and inclusion of like LGBTQ characters, which obviously Night Vale has? But they've kept Night Vale going free, but where they've got their money from, or where they're sort of monetizing the book, which is not the same as the podcast, and Alice Is Still Dead.
Yes.
Which is, they're doing through Audible, I think.
Yes, and on iTunes as well, available.
Yeah, so they gave the first two away, and then you have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think they're probably right, that if they started charging for Welcome to Night Vale, their audience would drop off.
Mm-hmm.
If they were to stop doing Night Vale to do other things, their audience might not follow them. If they keep doing Night Vale, as well as doing other things, they keep that audience, and they keep that large audience. And at the end of every show, they get to go, and if you liked that, go there.
Yeah.
If you've got that audience, don't throw it away.
Mm-hmm.
So for the Wooden Overcoats guys, don't try to do Wooden Overcoats on Radio 4. Even though I've seen the reviews, this is as good as, you know, an audience comedy as you'll hear on Radio 4.
Yeah, yeah.
Keep doing Wooden Overcoats, because that's the thing that people like.
Yeah.
But then say, we are also capable of.
Mm-hmm.
What's your next idea?
Mm-hmm.
So if you have developed that audience, keep, for God's sake, keep them.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you're just someone talking to a microphone. There's no point without an audience. Especially true of comedy. Nothing's funny until it's told to someone. You know, David Sedaris isn't funny until someone reads it. It has to be the other person that makes it funny. So I think if you are having success in the online world, keep at it, because that's really valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the sort of thing that makes producers and commissioners like, oh, they're doing that. Even if you've got, you know, broadcast work to do, try and keep that audience, because they will keep following you.
Mm-hmm.
But once you start putting up pay barriers, there's going to be a drop off. There's always going to be a drop off.
Sure.
So keep your audience as large as possible, because then the largest possible number of people will keep following you. Whereas if you stop doing what you're doing and just go entirely pay only, you'll find 10% of people will follow you. And how long will they stay with you for?
Sure.
And it feels bad to tell people to work for free. It feels very, very, that's wrong. People shouldn't work for free. But that audience is valuable to you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And talking of that, where can our audience find information on you and your programmes?
I bought a website last year when I went freelance. So if you go to edmorris.com, you can find out stuff. Or I'm on Twitter as Ed Morris, where I'm largely talking about football. So if you like analysis of Leeds United, I would recommend that. And if you don't, give it a skip. But yeah, that's where you can find me.
Marvellous. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been wonderful talking to you, and keep on being funny and amazing. I'm not even going to ask you to tell us your favourite joke for the end. You can put that on Twitter. Have a lovely everything. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that. We'd like to thank Ed Morris for his time, and thanks, Sarah, for interviewing him. That was brilliant.
Oh, cheers. Good fun. He's a good man, and I think there's so many amazing projects that he's doing that. You can find pretty much links to all the things that we were talking about on either the show notes, or if he was talking about specific people, then if you don't know of them already, then they are, I'm sure, easily Googleable, or whatever is your favourite search engine of choice.
All those other ones that people very regularly use, of course, yes. And of course, if you have any comments, please tell us at the Facebook group, Audio Drama Production Podcast. Or of course, you can email us, always do that, at podcast@audiodramaproduction.com.
Yeah, and massive, huge thanks and fireworks and exploding everythings to a wonderful Scooter, our newest patron, who
thank you.
We are very grateful for adding another something or other to our pot. So yes, thank you so much, Scooter, and we hope everybody jumps on now and has a good listen to your Anansi story time of podcast you're working brilliantly hard on. So many cool adventures to be heard at once.
Absolutely. And of course, thank you again to all our other Patreons as well.
Yes, all of you. You're amazing. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you. And to let you know as well, Matthew has an amazing resource, especially for people starting out, on thepodcasthost.com. If you go there, again, we'll put a link on our website, but he has written an amazing guide to making a fiction podcast right from those very first story seeds all the way through production to monetizing it at the end. Great read, really worthwhile.
Yeah, that's all.
Check it out.
Very cool. And we've also had an email from Anders in Stockholm. Hello, Anders. Good day.
Hello.
We also are keen to get some key resources on our site for people to use. So today we're looking at things like contract templates for voice actors and people working on projects. If you've got specific ones that you'd like to share, it'd be really lovely to have examples and samples of those on our site so that other people can fathom what to do when they get to that. And things like NDAs, your non-disclosure agreements, for specific reasons that, you know, you don't want the person involved in your project to spill all the beans. So as a professional outfit, you want to have that. So if you have an NDA or any of those contracts, it'd be lovely if you could share them with us and send them to our email address, which, as Fiona will tell you, is
podcast@audiodramaproduction.com. Oh yes. I'm on it this week.
You got it. I'll remember it one day.
Only took 7 episodes.
We've done 7. Amazing. They haven't kicked us off yet. So thank you so much to Ed, and hope you all have an amazingly creative and fun week. Don't forget all the hashtags, #tripod, #audiodramasunday, and our #ADPodBingo is still going strong. So share all of your hard work with the world by jumping on those and sharing. And thank you to all the people who have contributed to all of our discussions on the forum too. You make our lives more exciting by the day.
Absolutely. You do. Thank you very much indeed. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.